the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 114 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Mutiny in the Colonial Army. Another episode of You Are There, followed by The Rest is History with Simon Salt. I'm your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. I hope you're enjoying these Journey Into History segments. I know it seems like that's all I'm doing lately. I really was trying not to run these back-to-back, but I'm also trying to run them on the date that they actually happened. Since this happened on this date, I wanted to air it on this date as it happened in history. I'd appreciate any feedback on these segments. A couple of people have said that they enjoyed it. I am working on some other shows and finding some other things to feature here. But these, as they come, as I've selected them, I need to run them. I think you'll like this one. If you know anything about American history, you have to have heard about the Revolutionary War. Actually, anywhere in the world, you've probably heard about the Revolutionary War, where the British colonies in North America rebelled against the reign of King George, and they were tired of being taxed without being represented in the British Parliament. And many, many other factors. I think there's a lot of things that we overlook when we think about American history, especially around the Revolutionary War and all the factors leading into it. And we kind of glamorize this portion of American history. And it is spectacular. And it is an amazing piece of history and just amazing that this, in the way that everything unfolded and took place. And I'm proud to be an American. I'm proud of the heritage of my ancestors, and I've actually traced my family history or genealogy back to John Alden and Priscilla Mullins, who came over on the Mayflower. And, you know, there's the love triangle there with John and Priscilla and Miles Standish. And it was interesting, actually, about a month or so ago, we got an email from the website that we use to do our genealogy, and it would let you look up your history and see if you were related to several different groups of people, and one of those groups was U.S. presidents. And I found out that I am indirectly related to George Washington, who we're going to talk about today. And according to this, George Washington is my eighth cousin, 17 times removed. And so I found that pretty interesting. And there was other presidents that I was related to and other famous people, and even going back to British royalty and things like that. So it was very interesting and informational to get that. But since we're just talking about George Washington today, I thought I'd tell you how I'm related to him. Let's go ahead and get on with the show here. As we've talked about before, this You Are There radio show was done by CBS. And they reenacted the events of several historical events as if there were live reporters there on the scene at the time. And they did a really good job, and I really enjoyed these. But right now you can come with me, and that's Journey into Colonial America.
You now to come at the Frog with another fast-breaking news story.
Now, you see, Charlie, there's going to be a lot of sounds in this interview. No, that's the sound of the letter P. See the sign right there? See those big P's there? Piper's Pickled Peppers. No, that's Piper's Pickled Peppers. What's that, Charlie? Wipe off the microphone? Hi all there. This is Kermit the Frog, and I'm speaking to you from the pickled pepper patch of Peter Piper, who's famous for picking a peck of pickled peppers.
Mr. President,
yes.
Your troops have complained that while they were starving at Valley Forge, you were cooking extravagant gourmet meals for yourself.
Now let me make this perfectly clear. I am not a cook.
Sir?
Yes?
What's been the hardest aspect of your job?
Most difficult aspect is posing for the dollar bill. You see, I might point out the artist does them one at a time. And you really have to be patient. Because they're going to make a lot of them. Probably millions of them, and I have to sit for each one of those. That's why it takes a lot of time. I have to be very patient. As I am here. Yes.
Why do you wear a powdered wig?
What the hell would you wear with the velvet knee pants and stockings?
Now get to it. We march in half an hour.
Where are we marching to, sir?
Back to the boats and across the river.
But the men are exhausted. They're sleeping in the roads, in the meadows. They can't hold their heads up.
I too am exhausted, gentlemen. Now listen to me. We have won our first victory in 12 months. We have attacked the enemy for the first time, and out of some miracle, or the graciousness of God, or the idiocy of war, we have survived. What can you be thinking? Have we won a war? Gentlemen, this is only the beginning of a war. We have 2,000 men. The enemy has 20,000. And I swear I will not eat, nor will I sleep, until I put that river between him and us.
This is John Bailey of Princeton, New Jersey. On this 8th day of January, 1781, America's war for independence hangs in the balance. In a few moments, here on a wind-swept parade ground, Governor Joseph Reed of Pennsylvania will offer General George Washington's terms to the 11 mutinous regiments of the Pennsylvania line. These regiments, the bulk of General Washington's Continental Army, mutinied last week over allegedly intolerable conditions. If today they accept Governor Reed's proposals from General Washington, they will go back into the line. If they refuse, it is feared that they will desert to the British, and the armed might of the United States of America will collapse, ending in disaster this country's five-year-old struggle for independence from England. Everywhere in the nation on this cold January morning, from Boston to Savannah, the fears and the hopes of Americans are centered on this windy field.
January 8th, 1781, Princeton, New Jersey. You are there.
Mutiny in General George Washington's Continental Army. Insurrection so critical that it endangers the war for independence. CBS takes you back 168 years to an obscure but decisive crisis in the birth of the American Republic. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Princeton, New Jersey, a windswept parade ground, and John Bailey.
From Washington to the mutinied regiments of the Pennsylvania line, the fate of American independence will be decided. Last Monday, New Year's Day, at Mount Kemble, their winter headquarters, these 11 regiments, comprising some 2,000 soldiers, killed and wounded several of their officers and then marched out of camp. They took the road to Philadelphia, causing panic in that city and among the members of the Continental Congress there. The men were in a wild, explosive mood. No one knew what their plans were. Some said they meant to loot Philadelphia. Others thought that they were on their way to desert to the British. But arriving here at Princeton on Wednesday, they seized the buildings of the College of New Jersey, set up a fortified camp,
and elected a board of sergeants. This board permitted no one, not even officers, to enter. But finally, last Saturday, following extensive communication with General Washington at Continental Army headquarters at West Point, Governor Reed of Pennsylvania advised the board that he wished to offer terms, and the sergeants invited him to Princeton. Governor Reed will announce General Washington's offer to an assembly of the regiments drawn up on the field here. The troops are, as a matter of fact, falling in by regiments now. The governor is at Colonel George Morgan's mansion at the south end of the parade ground. With him is General Anthony Wayne, executive officer of the Philadelphia line. They're waiting there for the troops to complete their assembly. The big question is, what are General Washington's terms, and will the troops accept those terms? For an analysis of that question, we take you now to our headquarters booth here at the College of New Jersey and Major George Fielding Elliott.
First of all, let's look at what the Pennsylvania troops want. The men mutinied because they didn't have enough to eat. They were poorly clothed and supplied. They weren't paid regularly. They received their last pay 6 months ago. But most important of all, these veterans of the line want to be discharged from the service and go home. The men claim that their officers tricked them. Most of them can't read or write. They signed their names with a mark, and they say they thought they were signing up for 3 years. On the other hand, the officers of the Pennsylvania line insist that the men knew that they were signing up for the duration of the war. Of course, the officers have the problem of keeping an army together to fight the war. Now, how can General Washington cut this Gordian knot? He can't discharge all the men. To do so would be to demobilize the bulk of his army. It would open the way for the British to Philadelphia. Other state lines have similar grievances, and such a settlement would be literally inviting them to mutiny. It would mean the disintegration of the whole of Washington's army. General Washington, of necessity, must offer the men much less than they demand. In their present mood, however, it seems doubtful that they will accept less. If they don't accept General Washington's offer, the men may desert to the British in New York. Of course, that too would mean disaster for the war for independence. And so, that's the situation. A very grave and critical situation. Well, here at Princeton, the troops have still not completed their assembly. And at West Point, New York, Arthur Haynes is ready to interview General George Washington himself on this matter. So, over to West Point.
General Washington is with us now at our microphone. General Washington, can you tell us the terms Governor Reed will offer for you to the Pennsylvania mutineers?
I regret that I cannot. Governor Reed has agreed with the Board of Sergeants representing the troops at Princeton that the terms will be made public only on the parade ground, to all the men at the same time.
I see. Well, does the fact, General, that the Board of Sergeants has agreed to this mean that the Board itself has accepted the terms?
No, as I understand it, the Board of Sergeants is not empowered to accept any terms. Only the troops can do that.
Well, then, do you think, General Washington, that the troops will accept the terms?
Well, I think the complaints of the men are fully justified. I've begged and pleaded with the Congress and the respective state governments to take action to right their wrongs. Unfortunately, our legislators have failed to act, and so the troops have acted instead. Acted rashly, yes, but now I believe they've had time to consider the grave possibilities inherent in their impulsive action. I'm certain they must realize that if our struggle for independence is to to continue, it's impossible to grant what they ask. They must compromise. You know, I cannot find it in my heart to believe that the men who stood fast with us 3 years ago at Valley Forge will become traitors today at Princeton.
General Washington, what about the reports that the mutineers are being led by British agents?
Oh, I refuse to believe that.
You don't think, then, that the agents of the enemy are among the troops at Princeton?
Oh, certainly they are. The enemy has definitely infiltrated our ranks everywhere. Their agents take advantage of difficult conditions in the army to stir up discontent. But discontent, sir, is not treason. No, I would stake my life and all that I hold dear that the men of Pennsylvania are not treasonous. They must remain loyal today. They must listen to the voice of reason and patriotism. They must accept our terms.
Thank you, General George Washington.
General, this
is Arthur Hannes at Continental Army Headquarters, West Point, New York. We return you now to our CBS headquarters booth at Princeton and Major George Fielding Elliott.
Our Philadelphia newsroom informs us that a short while ago, CBS correspondent Don Hollenbeck returned from enemy-held New York City. He passed through the lines under safe conduct to interview Sir Henry Clinton, Commander-in-Chief of British Forces, for his views on the mutiny of the Pennsylvania line. Hollenbeck made a tape recording of the interview, and our Philadelphia newsroom will play it for you now. Bear in mind, of course, that Sir Henry Clinton speaks as the enemy military commander. Much of what he says may be discounted as propaganda. CBS, however, has verified the factual information in the interview, and it may have important bearing on the situation at Princeton. The next voice you hear will be that of Don Hollenbeck speaking by tape recording.
We're in the library of the mansion near Bowling Green, which Sir Henry Clinton has taken over as his personal residence. A reception is in progress here. The guests are dancing in the drawing room to a minuet by Haydn. But Sir Henry has taken leave of them to grant us this interview. Sir Henry, sir, may we have your opinion on this mutiny of the Pennsylvania line?
Oh, pleasure, sir. Very great pleasure. The spectacle in the New Jersey colony is a happy omen. What shall shortly come to pass in all of His Majesty's colonies in America.
I see. You expect the other state lines to follow the Pennsylvanians into mutiny.
Oh, indeed, sir, I do. Why do you suppose Washington and the Continental Congress are offering terms? Mutineers. Rather degrading, what? The commander of an army and the government of an alleged nation on their knees before common soldiers, pleading, entreating them to obey orders. And why, sir, do you suppose force has not been employed to quell the mutiny? I shall tell you why. Because even Washington's own men at West Point are on the verge of mutiny. My intelligence informs me that everywhere the Continental troops are coming to their senses. And the civilians as well.
Well, you think, then, sir, that the rest of the states may end their war for independence?
The respective colonies, sir, have had enough. His Majesty's subjects now realize full well the folly, the madness of the criminal sin they have committed in rebellion against the crown. They are turning, as they should, in righteous wrath against their misleader. And as His Majesty's Commissioner for the Peace, I am prepared to forgive. To welcome all the prodigals back to His Majesty's sovereign embrace.
Yes, I understand, sir.
Well, that's very good of you.
Sir Henry, is it true that your agents are busy among the Pennsylvania mutineers, encouraging them to return to His Majesty's sovereign embrace?
It is true that I have dispatched a personal representative to the Pennsylvania line. He is Mr. John Mason, a civilian of New York City. And he will make known to the troops the conditions under which I shall be disposed to receive them.
And what are those conditions, Sir Henry?
I very much fear me that you shall have to wait upon Mr. Mason for that intelligence, sir.
Well, Sir Henry, do you think that the men will accept those conditions?
Certainly, certainly. Mark my words, sir. It is only a matter of days before Mr. George Washington and his despicable crew of traitors will be hanging from the trees in so-called Independence Square in Philadelphia. And now, sir, my compliments, my guests await me.
Thank you so much, Sir Henry Clinton.
This is George Fielding Elliott in Princeton again. The interview you just heard was a tape recording made by Don Hollenbeck at British headquarters in New York City. And now the troops of the Pennsylvania line have completed their assembly on the parade ground outside. Governor Reed is ready to address them. So, over to John Daly.
The men of the Pennsylvania regiments are drawn up before a platform here at the west end of the field. Governor Reed, General Wayne, and their party are at the foot of the platform now. They came out of Colonel Morgan's mansion a few minutes ago. The governor is talking to Sergeant Bowser, the secretary of the Board of Sergeants. He's a small man, thin, almost emaciated, and I should judge about 60 years old. Before the war, he was a printer in Philadelphia. The men of the 11th Pennsylvania Regiment standing rigidly at attention in this raw, biting wind must feel it penetrate their ragged and tattered uniforms, so shabby and meager that they're hardly to be called uniforms. Their faces are thin with hunger and blue with cold, and they're silent, utterly without expression. You can't help wondering what they think as they see Governor Reed and the other members of the delegation from the Continental Congress, fresh from comfortable Philadelphia, seemingly untouched by the rigors of war. And now Sergeant Bowser and Governor Reed are mounting the platform. There's the drum roll. In just a moment, the sergeant will speak.
Men, it is a foul day for ill-clad and poor-shod lads to be standing outdoors. So I'll not belabor you with talk. You know what Governor Reed is here for, so let's give ear to what His Excellency has to say.
Soldiers of Pennsylvania, General Washington believes that you have acted not as traitors, but out of a sense of outrage and indignation caused by conditions which you deem intolerable. Let me therefore list the proposals of your commander-in-chief to alleviate those conditions. Firstly, a pair of shoes, overalls, and a shirt will be delivered out to each soldier in a few days. Secondly, the arrears of pay will be made up as soon as circumstances will permit. Thirdly, no soldier or non-commissioned officer shall be retained in the service beyond the period of his enlistment. Fourthly, in cases where enlistment records are in dispute, the government will set up a board to settle whether such soldiers have enlisted for the duration of the war or for 3 years only. Fifthly, a general amnesty will be granted. There will be no retaliation or punishment. This incident will be allowed to pass into oblivion. Then those are the terms. Discuss them, vote on them. If you are loyal Americans, if you are patriots, you will accept them. I shall await your decision in the Morgan match.
Finishing his address, Governor Reed steps back and motions to Sergeant Bowser.
All right, the sergeant again. You have heard the governor. You will now fall out and proceed at once to your quarters. There you will find copies of General Washington's proposal, which His Excellency has made available to us.
The men are breaking ranks, falling out and returning to their quarters. Governor Reed and Sergeant Bowser are coming down the platform, and the sergeant evidently will escort the governor, General Wayne, and the others back to the Morgan Mansion. But here's Sergeant John Williams, the president of the Board of Sergeants. Let's see if we can get a reaction on General Washington's terms from him. Sergeant Williams.
Yes?
Sergeant, what do you think of General Washington's proposals to end your mutiny? Are you in favor of accepting?
Nay, sir, I am not.
Why not, Sergeant?
Tis a waste of time to consider General Washington's terms. We ought to be going to the British.
Why? Don't you believe General Washington means what he says?
Promises. Since 79, we've had naught but promises. And a man wear words on his back, and he buy rum at the taverns with promises. And what's to be done about discharging the men who served their 3 years in the army? General Washington makes a pretty offer, indeed. A government war to decide who's to go home and who isn't. Mister, we all want to go home.
Then you won't accept a compromise.
We can't accept a compromise. If we put down our guns, our officers will hang all our leaders and punish the men. They'll be hanging and flogging to make examples of us for the rest of the army.
But Sergeant, General Washington promised a general amnesty, no retaliation.
Blast General Washington. We can't trust any man's word. We've got to go to the British.
What about the revolution, Sergeant Williams? Have you thought about the effect the desertion of the Pennsylvania line will have on the rest of the country?
The revolution is lost. It was lost long before we mutinied at Mount Kemble. Lost by the fat-bellied civilians drinking and swilling to their heart's content while we soldiers were starving in the field. So I say finish. Make peace with the British.
Thank you, Sergeant Williams. Now, another opinion on General Washington's terms. This one from the Secretary of the Board of Sergeants, who is at the Morgan Mansion. Go ahead, Jack Walter.
Sergeant Bowser, I just heard the president of your Board of Sergeants tell John Daly that he's not in favor of accepting General Washington's terms. Do you agree with Sergeant Williams?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, lad. And it's a mighty difficult thing to do.
Well, Sergeant Williams predicts that the men will reject Governor Reed's proposals and will go over to the British.
They might do that, and I'm not the man to judge them or blame them. We've had much grief and misery.
Then do you also think, as Sergeant Williams does, that General Washington is only offering the terms to get the troops to lay down their weapons and not because he means to meet your demands?
Lad, I believe General Washington is a good man.
But even good men will go back on their word if they consider it to be a harsh necessity. The general might betray us in the interest of maintaining discipline.
You believe it's right then, Sergeant Bowser, to jeopardize independence for the safety of 2,000 men?
That's a question, lad. Many of the men are saying the war is lost, and they may be right. And if the war is lost, lad, we shall have to answer to the British for taking up arms against them. Perhaps it is a wiser thing to make peace. British now and save our necks.
I see. Then you'll vote to reject the governor's offer.
Nay, lad, nay, I didn't say that. I only said it is a question, a difficult question. And no man is going to rush me into making up my mind.
Well, you haven't got much time, Sergeant. Don't you think... Excuse me, Sergeant Bowser. Ned Calmer at Nassau Hall, one of the college buildings, reports that Mr. John Mason, the enemy agent mentioned by Sir Henry Clinton, has arrived at the headquarters of the Board of Sergeants. So now, over to Ned Calmer.
Mr. John Mason arrived here a few minutes ago. He has brought Sir Henry's offer to the troops, and the board has received the offer and is already passing news of it to all the men in their quarters. Sergeant Williams has given us permission to interview Mr. Mason, and he's here with us now at the microphone. Mr. Mason, would you tell us the terms of the offer that you brought to the troops from Sir Henry Clinton?
I should be delighted. If the Pennsylvania troops will now lay down their arms and return to their true allegiance, they will be paid in hard cash, the money due them from the rebel government, and all possible comforts will be supplied to them.
And if the men accept this offer, Mr. Mason, will they be expected to serve in the British rank?
Not at all. No further military service will be asked of the troops, except it may be voluntary. The Pennsylvania regiment...
Excuse me, Mr. Mason. Governor Reed has just entered the room. He's talking to Sergeant Williams. Let's hear what he says.
Your information is correct, Governor. Meet Mr. John Mason, representing His Majesty's government. Mr. Mason, Governor Joseph Reed of the state of Pennsylvania.
You do, sir.
Sergeant Williams, I demand that this man be shot at once.
You're not in the Pennsylvania Council now, Governor.
You gave me your word that you are treating in good faith. Now you must prove it. If you put this spy to death...
Oh, you mistake.
Yes, you are a spy. And if you put him to death, Sergeant Williams... It will mitigate the offense of leading the regiment into mutiny.
I couldn't put this gentleman to death if I wanted to. The men know he's here. If they vote down General Washington's offer, they'll need him when they go to the British.
I demand that you...
I may be permitted.
Be silent, Mr. Mason.
You, sir, are a rebel. You represent an illegal body. You have no lawful authority whatever to command these men in any fashion.
How dare you?
I dare, sir, to inform Sergeant Williams that if I should be injured in the slightest... Sir Henry Clinton's offer to the Pennsylvania Regiment will be automatically null and void.
Sergeant Williams, this is an order. Shoot this man at once.
I'm issuing the orders here, Governor. And my orders are that Mr. Mason is guaranteed his safety until after the men vote. That's all.
This will not be forgotten.
Governor Reed is leaving the room. His face is white with anger. And now Ken Roberts is out there on the field with one of the groups of Pennsylvania men who are going to have to decide soon whether to accept or reject that British offer. Let's find out what's going on there now. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
Here with me at the microphone is Ensign General Tom Peters of the 3rd Regiment. He has some pretty strong opinions on the British proposal.
Aye, sure I've got strong opinions. I say, take the British offer. I've been in the line for 5 years, ever since 76. I enlisted for 3 years. I've had enough of war, enough of fighting. I want to get out while I'm still alive.
Stand, Driver Peter. Now, here's another man also with the 3rd Infantry. His name is... What's your name again, soldier?
Jim Allerin.
Well, what do you say, Jim? Do you agree with Tom Peters about deserting to the British?
Fight. That's what I want to do. Fight the British, not join them. I didn't mutiny to desert to the enemy. I'm not a traitor. I left the line because we weren't being treated right. But now General Washington's given us fair terms for a settlement, and I say, let's take those terms. Let's settle this thing. Let's get back at the enemy.
Fight, fight. That's all you youngsters want to do. Fight. How long have you been in, Halloran?
10 months. What of it?
You see what I mean? 10 months. Wait till he sees his friends killed, dead on the field, like I did at Monmouth, Stony Point, Brandywine. Wait till he starves, like I did at Valley Forge. Wait till he hasn't seen his wife and children for 5 years.
And how will that family of yours take to you with a mark of traitor on you? Do you think your friends will welcome you back?
I don't care about my friends.
Your wife, then, do you think she'll open her arms to you? A deserter?
My wife will have me back and glad to have me. Aye, no matter what I am. And that goes for all the veterans in this camp.
You're a big dumb ox. You're a turncoat, a traitor. That's what you're good for. To polish the boots of the British.
Watch your tongue, you young fool.
You're a wife.
There's the assembly call. The men are being summoned to fall in by regiment. It must be voting time, so back to John Daly at the platform.
It is voting time, the crucial vote on General Washington's proposals to end this mutiny and carry on the nation's fight for independence is about to be taken. Sergeant Bowser tells us that the men will vote by a show of hands, a simple majority to decide. The sergeant also tells us that at present there are exactly 1,991 men in the line. If 1,000 men vote in favor, General Washington's proposals will be accepted. Tellers have been appointed for each regiment, and the men are falling in quickly. The assembly is almost complete now. There's a little talk, but the discussion is over, really. Now it's up to each individual soldier. There's the drum roll. Sergeant Bowser is on the platform. In a moment, we'll hear him speak. Let's listen.
Men, there are two ways you can go. If you take the road to the British, it'll bring you out safe and sound. But the price is shame and treason. If you take the road that leads back into the line, there's also a price to be paid. You'll be putting your lives in the hands of General Washington. And if he gives you your lives, you may lose them again on the battlefield. Because there's still a war to be fought, and only the good Lord knows whether it's to be won or lost. Now, men, we'll vote on Governor Reed's proposals. All those in favor of accepting them and going back into the line, raise your right hand and raise them high so the tellers can see them.
And hands are going up all over the field. It's impossible to tell how many of the men are voting in favor of General Washington's proposals, but roughly, I'd say a little more than half, but we can't be sure. It's going to be a tight vote in any case. The tellers are moving up and down the ranks, making their count as they move among the men. There are several tellers for each one of the regiments, and they are working swiftly. Now they're signaling up to the platform that the eye count is in, Sergeant Bowser.
Now, let's see the hands of the men who are against accepting General Washington's proposals. Up with them now, up high.
Well, there seem to be somewhat fewer hands, but still I can't be sure. Standing up here on the platform, looking out over these men as they're standing in rows on the field, it's impossible to count them, but there do seem to be fewer hands. And once again, the tellers are moving up and down through the ranks, making their count. Governor Reed, on the south end of the field, has come out to watch. General Wayne is with him. Also, the members of the Continental Congress delegation who have come up, as we told you, from Philadelphia. John Mason, the British agent, is at the west end of the field under guard, and he's watching the vote with Sergeant Williams. If the men are loyal, he most likely will be summarily shot as a spy. Now the tellers are beginning to move toward the platform to report to Sergeant Bowser, and of course they will give him the individual regimental counts, and he'll have to total them before we have a final figure. As I said before, the Pennsylvania line numbers 1,991 men. A vote of 1,000 will be decisive one way or the other. Sergeant Bowser's up there busy now with the tellers who've come up from the ranks. He's checking his figures with two members of the board, and in a moment, we'll know the result. We'll know whether the men of the Pennsylvania line... Here's the result.
You've made your decision. The count is 781 against and 1,210 for. We are going back into the line, lads. And may God help us.
The mutiny of the Pennsylvania line is over, and the men are returning to their duty. General Washington's faith in the patriotism of the men who fought and suffered with him for independence for five long years has been justified. And you can only imagine the intense relief and gratification that he will feel at this inspiring news. It'll undoubtedly give a new stimulus and...
January 8th, 1781. The men of Pennsylvania turned their backs on treason, and the war for independence goes on to victory.
You have been listening to Mutiny in the Continental Army, another broadcast produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. Mutiny in the Continental Army was written by Michael Sklar and Mr. Cheyenne. Thorin Thatcher played General Washington. Anthony Kemble Cooper was Sir Henry Clinton. Eric Dressler played Governor Reed, and the cast included William Podmore, Stats Cotsworth, Bernard Lenroe, Joseph Boland, Bob Reddick, Guy Sorrell, and others. Next week,
May 6, 1802, the betrayal of Toussaint Louverture. You are there.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
So there you go. There's the account of the mutiny of the Colonial Army. One time I was in the Boston area, and I had an afternoon and evening to just go explore Boston. I was actually surprised to be able to go see so many different things while I was there in Boston. I didn't have a lot of time, but I was able to go to a lot of places. I went to Bunker Hill and spent a lot of time there. I went and saw the old Ironsides, the battleship. I went to the, what's the name of it? I should look it up. But anyway, it's the chapel, the Paul Revere chapel where he lit the lamp and to let everybody know that the British were coming. Went to Faneuil Hall and just saw a lot of different historical things and really, really enjoyed that. I wish I could have spent more time, but I'm grateful for the things that I was able to see while I was there. And I'd love to do a tour of the New England area and to visit all these sites and see these things. I also went to Plymouth Rock, which wasn't all that spectacular, but of course the history is. I was able to see the reproduction of the Mayflower and was surprised how small it was. Like, as I said, you know, I have history there with my ancestors. And so I just find that fascinating. So we better move on here. Simon has a lot of good things to talk about as well. Let me tell you a little bit about Simon. Simon Salt has been a student of history since a high school teacher turned him onto it and really brought the subject to life for him. Ever since then, he's been an avid reader, amateur historian, and consumer of all things historical. He is also a professional photographer, an author, and a keynote speaker. He's originally from England, and he moved to the U.S. 12 years ago. He currently lives outside of Atlanta, Georgia, where he submerses himself in both the colonial and Civil War history of the area. So he has a lot of good insight, and so you've heard the report. It's time to turn it over to Simon. And the rest is history.
Hi, this is Simon Salt, and you're listening to The Rest is History. So, a mutiny in the Colonial Army. Not something we think of when we think of the way the Colonial Army is portrayed in history. Certainly not the way that it is portrayed in popular culture and popular media. We think of perhaps the great colonist Mel Gibson, who's of course Australian, but never mind the details, as the patriot, with he and his family all joining the cause and all of the able-bodied men in the area joining up to fight the evil dominance of the British. We think of Paul Revere and the Redcoats Are Coming and his warning that the British were going to put down this rebellion. Well, history shows us in actuality things were a little bit different than that. Firstly, we have to remember that whilst in 1781, by the time of 1781, the nomenclature had changed somewhat, and so people were referring to the colonies as states, they really weren't states. They were really still colonies. And very much as they are today, they are a loose amalgam of people with similar ideas. But the overarching identity of America had yet to be formed. So at this time, we've got this colonial army led by this General Washington, who came from a rich Virginia family and was, as history shows us, probably a much better general than he was a commanding officer or a strategist. What he did do, and many captains of industry have found this to be the most advantageous thing, is to appoint people who are better than you to do those jobs. And that was Washington's real talent. It was less of him as a strategist and planning the defeat of the British, but rather it was finding people who were good officers, good generals, who would serve under him and who could plan those things, who could identify where to hit the British and how to do it. But Washington had a problem with this loose confederation. It had been decided that the colonial army would in fact be supplied and provided for at the state level, which is why we refer to things like the Pennsylvania Line. This was a regiment, or a series of groups of regiments, actually 11 infantry and one artillery, that were provided by the state of Pennsylvania. And that state was responsible for clothing, feeding, and paying its soldiers. Now, Washington had long petitioned the Central Continental Congress that they should, in fact, be paying for it, that they should, in fact, be supplying the army. It was, after all, the Continental Army. And it was supposed to be under a unified command, his. So he was trying to petition the Continental Congress. The generals in charge of the regiments were in turn petitioning their own state governments. And all of the politicians had one thing in common. None of them wanted to spend any money. In fact, they expected the individuals to just get out there and fight, just to be patriots, to understand the bigger picture, the cause that was being fought for, and fight for that. And never mind about clothing and food and ammunition and weapons and being paid to do it. They should just get out there and do it. Because certainly the states had better things to spend their money on. Quite what they were going to spend their money on, I have no idea. Given that if the army failed, they would all come back under British control. And what British control would mean was quite simply a heavy persecution of those who had rebelled. There was no doubt that the British would exact punishment and certainly hang and otherwise execute Washington and the Continental Congress. So their reticence to pay the soldiers is a puzzle. Now, we have to remember as well that the mainstream media tends to portray the Continental Army and the militia as having been drawn from everyone. Everybody was eager to sign up, as young as they could, get in there and protect their country. In fact, that's not true. That's a very much a myth. It's estimated that only 3% of available fighting men actually joined up. At its peak, the Continental Army was a little over 18,000 troops, and certainly by 1781 it was down to 15,000. When you're going up against what was at the time considered the greatest military machine in the world, 15,000 men doesn't seem very many. And certainly that was Washington's biggest problem here with the revolt by the Pennsylvania line. About 50% of the line decided to mutiny. Now, this was an ongoing problem. This is not by any means the first mutiny, but all of the others had been much smaller. Yeah, a few dozen men here and there deciding that they weren't going to go back into battle with no shoes or no food or without being paid. And Washington, for the most part, had been able to leave that to his local commanders to resolve. But this was much bigger. This was between 1,500 and 2,000 men who had rebelled, who had in fact killed a couple of their officers, injured others, and had refused to return to barracks and had marched away. Now, they did agree with their commanding officer to set up this council of sergeants, one sergeant from each of the regiments to represent the group of men and their demands. Now, on a military note, at this time, a sergeant was, in fact, the highest non-commissioned officer rank. There weren't master sergeants and staff sergeants and warrant officers like we have in the modern military. So sergeants were very powerful. They were, you know, very well respected. They were looked upon as leaders by their men and often relied upon as such by the officers. So these men had gone for, and estimates vary, but at least 6 months and anything up to a year without being paid. They were living on bread and water where they could find it. They had little or no other form of provision. They had no winter provisions, no winter clothing. Often they had marched clean out of their boots, literally worn the leather away, and were in a very, very sorry state. The British, on the other hand, were, by comparison, extremely well provided for. The British soldiers were paid regularly, they were fed regularly, and they were clothed properly, and that was all provided by the government. They were a proper army. The colonial government had not quite got their head around that, which is, again, a surprise, given that many of the officers in the colonial army were, in fact, former British officers who had fought in the French Indian Wars and then had decided to stay and settle in the colonies and actually came over to the American side. They decided not to fight for the British. So Washington is faced with this revolt. What can he do? If he loses 1,500 men out of 15,000, that's 10% of his army. That's going to open the floodgates. And very soon he's going to lose his entire army. Something that the British are actually banking on. They want this to happen. They want to see the colonial army collapse so that they can simply, without any further warfare, take over the colonies again and restore them to the king. So Washington has to try and negotiate, and he hears the men's demands, and the men's demands are quite reasonable. They're based on the fact that a lot of the men were, of course, at that time, illiterate. And they had been promised to sign up here on this dotted line, just put your mark, and we'll sign you up for 3 years. What they weren't read was the rest of that contract, which was 3 years or until the end of the war. And so these men who had signed up in 1776, 1777, who should have been dismissed the year previous to this had not been. They were kept in the dark. When they said, well, we only signed up for 3 years, the officers denied this, showing them the contract, of course, which they couldn't read, that said, or until the end of the war. The men were in revolt. They didn't want this. They'd been signed up for 3 years. They'd been away from their homes for 3 years, and they wanted to go home. As far as they were concerned, they had, in fact, served their engagement, and it was time for them to separate. Now, we've seen this same situation in the US military since. In fact, in modern times, it is referred to as stop loss, where the US government retains the right to extend your contract beyond your normal point of retirement or separation for the exigencies of the service, usually during times of war. Vietnam, for example, First Gulf War, and more recently, the Second Gulf War. So we see that we haven't learned a lot. History repeats itself. We decide to retain the services of key military individuals when we need them, regardless of the contract they sign, even though that is actually part of the contract. So what did Washington do? Well, the men's demands were that they be released, those that had only signed a 3-year contract, that they be paid, that they be provided with the food and clothing that they needed to actually be able to work properly, to be able to fight. The men were given this option of taking the offer that Washington made them or suffering the consequences. Now, in reality, Washington had very few options in terms of negotiation. He had to rely on the fact that ultimately he understood the men's demands were actually reasonable, that they were not asking for anything that wasn't owed to them. And so the initial offer was that the men would be given shoes and shirts and overalls, arrears of pay, and that somebody would look into their enlistment question. They rejected that offer, mainly because there was no timeline given to them. Eventually, a compromise was reached, and they took those new terms. Half of the men who had revolted took discharges. The others took furloughs with bonuses for reenlistment. And part of that bonus for reenlistment was simply because when they had signed up in 1776, the bonus for joining was a paltry $20. By 1781, some of the states were offering as much as $120 to join up. They were also concerned about their treatment after they would given their demands. They were concerned that the pardon, the general pardon, would not be honoured. And they perhaps had some good insight into this. Their general pardon was honoured. Repercussions were negligible, and the men returned to duty and without punishment. However, their revolt inspired a further revolt of some 200 soldiers from New Jersey stationed in Pompton, and that Washington would not allow for. It was put down by soldiers from New York who were stationed nearby, and the two ringleaders were executed summarily. So the men of the Pennsylvania line, in fact, whilst revolting for good cause, were lucky. Washington took pity on them, but he most certainly did not accept the actions that they took. They had placed the army in a very bad position. They had placed Washington in the potential position of being defeated, in effect, by his own men. And Washington was not happy for this at all. that he managed to negotiate through the auspices of the commanding officer of the Pennsylvania line is, again, more of a statement of him being a leader rather than a commander of men. He was a good symbol. He was a great motivator to the officers beneath him, and they in turn took his lead and tried to be the same type of officer for their men. Ultimately, the officers' hands were tied by the Continental Congress and by the state governments. Again, nothing really much has changed. Politicians fund the military. The military does what it can to complete the mission with the options that the politicians provide them. And we see this today. The military is as hogtied and bound by politicians as they ever were. If Washington were alive today and Washington were to see how a modern army is run, I think he would find a lot of similarities. This has been The Rest is History. I'm Simon Salt, and I'll see you next time.
Well, there you go. There's Simon Salt, and The Rest is History. I think I've already talked enough about things, so I appreciate you listening to this podcast. I hope you stay tuned and enjoy these Journey into History segments, as well as other features that I'm preparing for you. So, until next time, stay safe out there, and journey on.
This is Julie Hoverson from 19 Nocturne Boulevard, and I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it, however, and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space.